from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This past weekend marked 3 years since the start of the uprising against the Assad regime in Syria. An estimated 150,000 people have died in the ensuing conflict and civil war. 9 million have fled their homes. The toll on Syria's children has been especially severe. They've witnessed horrors no child should ever see. They've seen loved ones dragged away, blown to pieces. They've suffered malnutrition, suffered from lack of medicine, lack of nearly everything. This hour on Point, Syria's suffering and the plight of Syria's children. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you still paying attention? What do you do with the images of rubble and pain and kids? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. We will talk in this hour with aid workers on the front lines in Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, all working with Syrian children. But first, joining me from Beirut for the latest on the conflict in Syria is Patrick McDonald, Beirut Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. Patrick, thank you very much for joining us.
Hello, Tom.
Is this conflict any nearer an end?
Hard to say, frankly, whether it's any nearer an end. I think what is clear is that Bashar Assad's government and his military have very much the upper hand. They've made significant advances in recent months. In the last 6 months, they've cleared out the vast tracts of central Homs province. They've cleared out large previously rebel-held zones around Damascus, the capital. Just last week, they captured a very key town, Yabrud, near the Lebanese border. So they're making significant advances. Whether that will translate into complete victory is unclear. Vast stretches of the country are no longer under government control.
We're talking in this hour, Patrick, about suffering. If Assad is gaining the upper hand, does that suggest the possibility of an Assad victory after all of this? And if it did, does that mean less suffering?
Those are big questions. I mean, I think that it's probably too early to talk about an Assad victory, but the situation a year ago, a year and a half ago anyway, people were basically thinking that Assad was going to fall in a matter of weeks or months. He was on his back foot. You'll recall there were constant rebel attacks in Damascus. The situation seemed very dire, and a lot of experts on the Arab world even, were saying that he would not last very long. Fast forward to now, and he seems to have a stronger grip on power, much stronger than then. They're talking about elections. There probably will be elections, which he'll undoubtedly be reelected. I was recently in Syria, and he has consolidated his support, and to some extent, one would expect him to have strong support among minority groups who've always supported him, particularly his Alawite groups. But when you talk now to even moderate Sunnis who don't particularly like Assad or his way of governing, they see the alternative, the rebels, and many have told me they prefer Assad to that alternative.
After all of this, Patrick, do you see the possibility of a return to the old Syria, its old borders, its old power structure?
You know, again, I'm not a very good prognosticator. I don't think it's out of the question, however, depending on what happens. This is very much a proxy conflict. You've got outside powers, including the United States, very involved in it. And the focus of a lot of the outside powers, I think the focus in Washington, to some extent, has shifted to viewing this battle as kind of a battle against terrorism, a counterterrorism effort. And I think the United States is very interested, and as is much of the West, in not seeing Syria become another Afghanistan, kind of a launching pad for terrorist attacks throughout the West. So if that's the case, there may be eventually some diplomatic interest in keeping Syria together and working out some kind of a modus vivendi there where the place is not, you know, basically a breeding ground for terrorist attacks.
Are you suggesting with that basically ceding it back to the Assad family? This has been the dynamic, or was the dynamic, for decades, just to keep order.
I'm not suggesting that. I'm just thinking of possibilities right now. I mean,
yeah.
How do we get out of this horrific humanitarian morass right now, in which you said more than 100,000 people have died, 9,000 people have been thrown out of their homes? It's a very hopeless scenario right now, and you know, people are just talking about more and more battles. I've recently spoken to some wounded fighters on both sides, and the overwhelming sentiment among all Syrians I've spoken to is that they're just tired of the fighting and want it to end. Now, whether there can be a diplomatic initiative to end that or not, I don't know. It's very clear that the Geneva initiative didn't work, but maybe there'll be some alternatives as this thing goes on and people see the absolute humanitarian imperative to stop this really catastrophic event.
Patrick, you've seen so much of this conflict, and most of us have not. After 3 years, just give us a sense of the scope of that humanitarian disaster, what you've witnessed.
Well, a couple of things. Firstly, just visually, as a writer, it's almost impossible to describe what Syria looks like. One becomes so used to writing about rubble-filled streets and neighborhoods that are turned to rubble, but it's quite striking. Driving north from Damascus, central Damascus is in pretty good shape, and you go across a certain visible line, and suddenly on both sides of the street, all you really see are Stalingrad or post-war Berlin, just bombed-out buildings, 5-6-story apartment buildings on both sides, with smoke coming from them, a crackle of gunfire, driver has to hit the accelerator, and that goes on for months. And some of those neighborhoods are relatively affluent. There are some car dealerships there, Lexus dealerships that are completely burned out. And one sees this everywhere. There's a huge neighborhood in home city called Haldia, used to be home to 50,000 people, and there's not a soul living there right now. It's just complete rubble. So this used to be home to people. Those people, a lot of them are in refugee camps. A lot of them have relocated. Many of them are in Lebanon. The scope of this is just becomes very hard to describe, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
And the children in the midst of this, Patrick, can you imagine them growing up, what they must think of life, the world?
It's pretty horrific. I live in Beirut, and the streets are unfortunately, lamentably, filled with Syrian children begging, polishing shoes, and it's a terrible sight. I think some large percentage of these refugee children aren't getting education. But then inside the country, for the people trapped in battle zones, the situation for children is even worse. I mean, I think there have been in some of the areas of the Eastern Duma that are still under rebel control, there's been a whole new curriculum. Schools have been stopped, and there's been some kind of ad hoc Islamic curriculum started. And even in government-controlled areas, I visited one neighborhood in Homs called Inshahat, where there were 6 or 7 schools. I think only 1 or 2 were actually being used as schools, and they were very crowded. The rest were being used as refugee centers because schools are one of the main places displaced people go to. So, yeah, children are suffering all over the place, and I think they've talked about, aid workers talk about a lost generation of children, and what those ramifications are going to be for generation or generations to come is somewhat unfathomable.
The number of children displaced just inside Syria, up from 900,000 to almost 3 million just in the last year. Patrick McDonald, Beirut Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. Patrick, thank you very much for spending a few minutes with us. Much appreciated.
My pleasure, Tom.
Here's a bit of reporting from NBC's Bill Neely earlier this month from a playground in Damascus.
We want life back the way it was, she says. Then, a blast. People are dying here. We just want to have fun, he says. Then, another. The boys flinch. But it's not over, and it's not far away. Shells are raining on us, he says. Panic in the playground. Let's go, a man shouts. Fast.
Panic in the playground, and here, from interpreted by CNN's Arwad Damon from Aleppo Media Center. One boy covered in dust and debris crying out after one of his sisters killed by a barrel bomb in Aleppo.
They killed my siblings. 6-year-old Mohammed cries out, covered in dust.
Many siblings. Joining me now from Washington is Cortland Robinson, Deputy Director at the Center for Refugees and Disaster Response at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He was in Lebanon in January, assessing health risks among Syrian refugee children. He's worked on refugee and displacement programs for more than 30 years. Cortland Robinson, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for inviting me.
You've worked in this arena, this sad arena, for a long time. How do you place what's unfolded in Syria in the context of the many, many bad scenes we've seen over those decades?
Well, I think the numbers speak for themselves. I think even for those of us who consider ourselves somewhat hardened by what we've seen over many decades, Cambodian border, Uganda, Sudan, tsunami in Indonesia, natural disaster, as well as conflict-affected situations. This is really historic proportions, both the 9 million displaced, 2.5 million refugees outside their country, 6.5 million internally displaced, millions more affected by the conflict. and of course the host populations in Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt, Turkey, and the region are also affected, and those populations also have kind of knock-on effects of this conflict depleting their access to services and resources available. So the numbers, I think, speak for themselves. I think the amounts of money that are being called for, I think more than $6 billion if you count the aid for Syria as well as the regional response. These are historic in scope and size, and I think we have to be careful not to be numb by them, but to remain focused on paying attention, I think, as you said right at the outset.
So much violence in such heavily populated areas. We've seen these pictures of apartment buildings just in tatters, in rubble. I'm not sure when the last time was that we saw this much firepower put against such concentrations of people, kids included.
Indeed. I think this is both the new face of conflict. It's more and more in urban areas, and it's a new face of displacement. We see so many populations, children included, displaced, not as we might imagine in sort of older times and days, broad African plains and encampments on in jungle areas in low-income settings, but really people displaced from middle-income countries into other middle-income countries, struggling to survive where costs are higher, services are harder to access, both by the international humanitarian community and by the local populations.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Syria's suffering and the plight of Syria's children in the fourth year now of Syria's crisis and war. So many millions displaced and so many millions trapped in the middle of vicious fighting. In September, BBC reporter Jeremy Paxman listened in on a classroom in the Baqa Valley refugee camp, one of the camps in East Lebanon.
Some of the children have seen things no one should ever have to see. All have read the fear and desperation in the eyes of their parents.
They sound cheery there in the classroom, but it can crumble. And inside Syria, NBC reporter Bill Neely visited a school filled with children who had fled the fighting. Many of them had fathers who had been killed, dragged away in front of their eyes.
Tarek describes how his father was shot dead. The detail unlocking a young girl's grief. Rodena and Dana can't hold their tears back. Dana describes how her father was dragged away by gunmen and never came back. When little Lilas tells her father's story, Rodena finds the courage to speak. He tried to keep us safe, she says.
He tried to keep us safe. And here's Secretary of State, U.S. John Kerry, just yesterday in Washington, explaining why Washington has taken a step of ordering the Syrian embassy closed and consulates to suspend operation.
140,000 people killed, more than 10,000 children, millions of refugees, millions of internally displaced people, people attacked by their own government with gas, people tortured and killed by the thousands.
You can join the conversation this hour. Do you look at the news from Syria or turn away now? And can you believe the brutality, the suffering, the barrel bombs and torture and siege and starvation? Can you imagine trying to live and raise children in this Syria? Imagine being a child there. 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Cortland Robinson has been with us from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health's Center for Refugees and Disaster Response. I want to go right to Damascus now, if we can. Inside Syria, Hamida Laseko joins us. She's deputy representative in Damascus for UNICEF. Hamida, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Tom. How are you?
We're okay. As a UNICEF representative in Damascus, do you have access to the zones of fighting? Do you see the suffering of the children, Hamida?
I would say that being a person on the ground, we see a lot. And actually, this civil war has just ripped off the society, the community. The children are really suffering. We have teams who are even not only in Damascus. We have UNICEF staff who are working outside Damascus in homes, in Tattoos, in Kamishli, and they see this suffering of the children day to day. Children are missing from schooling. Children are missing from health services. You can imagine this is a country whereby children used to enjoy education, being in a classroom, used to enjoy safe water, used to enjoy getting their food. But right now, these children are really suffering. We are here. I mean, we are witnessing. You asked me if we are seeing. Yes, we are seeing. Regarding the access, this is what we are asking. It is our big ask to all parties of the conflict that they should grant immediate access, particularly to those children. There is around a million children who are living either in besieged areas or in hard-to-reach areas. And therefore, parties to the conflict, we are asking them to stop this violence and to allow not only UNICEF, but also other humanitarian actors, so that they will be able to deliver humanitarian aid and other services to these children who are really under siege and who are really in very hard to reach and living conditions, whereby we can support them with vaccination, we can support them with safe water, we can support them with hygiene, and we can support them, most important, with going back to school.
I mean, you've got polio coming back in Syria, measles there, very little healthcare at this point. Hamida, help us understand. I'm reading here that 40% of Syrians have fled their homes. The equivalent in the United States would be 130 million people out of their homes. Where do those people live? How do they live displaced from their homes inside the country? We're going to look at refugee camps outside. But inside Syria, once you leave your home in the middle of this conflict, how and where do they live?
Definitely, this causes a lot of problems to those also who are hosting, because you can imagine that they have to go to different areas and to live in very appealing conditions. Without shelter, the weather has been, you know, it has been winter here, and therefore in many cases that children have been living in these conditions. And those who are hosting them, actually this is also extra burden for them. So even when we are asking for help, we are asking also to help those who are hosting these children, because most of the time you find either it is the schools will be congested. They have to do more shifts, and the teachers are not there. Some of the teachers have also flee out of their areas. Some of the teachers have been killed. Some of the teachers have gone out of the country. Same for the health facilities. So it is actually struggling for all services, and this makes the situation even much more worse.
Starvation as a tool of war here, many having lost their parents entirely. Again here, this is in the Damascus suburb, not so far from you, Hamida, of Yarmouk. This is NBC reporter Bill Neely talking with siblings who, in the middle of this conflict in Syria, had lost their parents.
The Rajab children were hungry and under siege for a year, and they are orphans now. Their father presumed killed, their mother gone, their bodies bearing scars of war. I was shot at, says Rajab, and hit by shrapnel.
And how did they eat? Here's Bill Neely again.
We picked grass and weeds to eat, says Mohammed, who is small for 12. We also bought bags of weeds to eat for $3.
Hamida Laseko, in Damascus, what is the flow of international aid or humanitarian aid of any kind into Syria now?
We are taking all opportunities whenever the access is available, and actually our main advocacy to both parties of the conflict is to grant the access. We are reaching those children. For example, if I can tell you, for polio vaccination, we were able to support with vaccination of 2.8 million children. This number is increased compared to the last campaign last month. However, we still need to reach more children, and we still need to get more access. And particularly, I would like to repeat to this more than a million children that are still not able to access, those who are in very hard to reach and those who are in besieged areas.
It's just heartbreaking. Hamida, please stand by. Cortland, I want to bring our callers in. Michael in Boston, you're on the air.
Hey, hi, Tom. My name is Michael Zikanda, calling from Boston. I have just a point. 3 years after conflict in Syria, I think it's about time that we're going to look after the support of this war. Because on the other side, Bashar al-Assad has been supported by the Russians and the Chinese. On the other side of the rebel, the Western countries are supporting the rebels. But there is no solution. We got to look after the support of this war. For the children are dying, they don't go to school, there is no way they can play no more. And the father are dying, the children are left behind by it.
Look who's supporting the war. We will look at that, Michael. Let me get one more right here, if I may. Melissa, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was watching the news about a month ago, and I saw the face of my daughter in the face of one of these children in the refugee camps. And she was 2, but she had only developed to the size and weight and height of a 1-year-old. And I couldn't breathe. I immediately called my senator, and I sent a letter to my senator, my U.S. senator, and I said, what are we doing? How are we not doing anything about these poor children? I still can't believe we're not doing anything. I know we don't want to get involved in wars, but we've got to do more.
But what would you have done, Melissa? What would you have done by the U.S.?
Well, you know, we do a lot of covert things. And how about we go and take this guy out? You know, that what if we just take him out? I said to my husband, I know that, you know, that's a terrible thought, but, you know, maybe it's the solution.
Maybe, though at this point, you've also got pretty tough activity on the part of Islamic fundamentalists inside Syria as well. But I feel that urge to do something here. Let me get one. Thank you, Melissa. Emanuela in Danbury, Connecticut. Emanuela, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I think part of the lack of global solidarity to the conflict in Syria also has to do with the way the 24-hour news cycles are handling as news. Once it was no longer interesting, we no longer see stories about Syria every day. And it's hard for the general American public to be compassionate and understand that how it affects us here and affects the areas in the region, and to see the children suffering and see how these kind of evil in the world is escalating and one day it can be right at our footsteps.
Emmanuel, I appreciate your call as well. If I may, let me take that to Damascus. Hamida, do you feel that this conflict and the struggles you see are being in some degree ignored by the world?
As a mother and as a person working for children, I think there is much more that the world can do and support these children. I think everybody has to be a voice of these children. And as much as there is quite a lot that is going on now in terms of advocating for these children, but still, and we really want to thank your radio also for taking up this, because I think this is one way also to make the world hear of how much these children are suffering. And therefore, I would say that we should not keep quiet. We should continue to advocate for this. And these children are children just like any other children in the world. They have the rights, and their rights needs to be fulfilled. And all those who are concerned, all those who are involved, who globally have to speak for these children. That's what I would say.
Hamida Laseko with UNICEF, Deputy Representative in Damascus, inside Syria. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Tom.
In Geneva yesterday, the UN Human Rights Council panel of investigators reporting in there. Paolo Dinheiro, the chairman of the panel, presented his case. He said that there are war crimes going on. He said the world has done little but bear witness to the plight of those caught in the maelstrom. Here he is.
Compassion does not and should not suffice. We cannot continue to sit for years in these rooms, writing reports, presenting reports, and making speech, lamenting the blood that is running in Syria's streets.
But there's plenty of that going on, if even that I want to go to Lebanon now, where there are a lot of refugees. Nigel Pont joins us. He's regional director for the Middle East for Mercy Corps, oversees Syria response from Beirut, joins us from Beirut. Nigel Pont, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Lebanon has not set up refugee camps for Syrians. They've kind of let them flow into the population. Why, Nigel?
I think, firstly, the Lebanese government really has to be commended for keeping their borders open, which has made Lebanon one of the very few safe havens for refugees fleeing from Syria. I think the history of refugee camps with the Palestinian crisis here in Lebanon has made the Lebanese government and communities particularly shy of establishing camps. Hence, the refugees are flowing largely into rented accommodation, living in host communities in urban areas largely, and in some cases in informal tented settlements.
We understand that they keep the border open, and that has been a great point of mercy, as you say, but we heard earlier just in this hour from Patrick McDonald with the Los Angeles Times that he sees Syrian children begging all over the streets of Lebanon. And we are also reading about crime syndicates exploiting these refugees inside Lebanon. I mean, what about the downside of this no formal camp structure?
Yeah, I think, Tom, in any of these refugee settings like this, you'll definitely see layers of tragedy. And it's definitely not a perfect situation here in Lebanon. And, some of the problems that you would see mitigated by establishing camps would would definitely be an advantage. However, I think that in camp settings, you can also have other layers of complication. So I think the important thing right now is that Lebanon continues to let refugees in and that we continue to really work hard to make sure that once the refugees are here in Lebanon, particularly for the vulnerable children and women, that we make sure that we put in place the systems, the structures, the services, and really work with the caregivers in particular so that they can create an environment which these kids can bounce back.
Nigel, there in Beirut, what percentage of the refugee population there are women and children? How many children? And do you see trauma?
Tom, it's hard to ignore this tragedy here in Beirut. There's a big flight of stairs outside my apartment where I often bump into a couple of shoeshine boys. They must be, I guess, 9 or 10 years old, though they look quite a bit older. It's hard for us to communicate. From what I understand of their story, they're from southern Syria, and both of their parents have been killed, and they now live on the streets of Beirut, trying to get by in their own entrepreneurial way, shining shoes and doing odd jobs. And I'm really struck by how polite and how cheerful they manage to be. However, you can really see the tragedy on their faces, and I'm struck by, on one hand, there's that very personal experience that I have with a couple of boys, yet I know that there's 1.2 million refugee children like these boys. Maybe some still have their parents, but the numbers are incredible. And of that, 425,000 are under five. And of all the refugee children here in Lebanon, only 20% are in school. So I think, the numbers involved in this crisis are staggering. And while the Lebanese government and the humanitarian community, we've been doing our best so far to really mitigate the effects of this crisis and help these children who are proving to be remarkably resilient, helping them to get back on their feet, there's just a lot more we can do, and we should be investing more.
Nigel, we just have 20 seconds. Do you expect these refugees will one day return to Syria, or are they in some perpetual limbo?
I think from Mercy Corps' perspective, I think that, a political solution is needed, and we hope that will happen. However, we're planning for the long haul, and we imagine that a lot of these children will grow up in the refugee setting.
Regional Director for the Middle East for Mercy Corps, Nigel Pont, with us there from Beirut. Nigel, thank you very much. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about Syria's suffering. and the plight of Syria's children in now the fourth year of Syria's crisis and war. Cortland Robinson joins us from the Center for Refugees and Disaster Response at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He joins us today from Washington. Earlier this month, NBC's Dr. Nancy Snyderman reported from a refugee camp in Lebanon just across the Syrian border. A 28-year-old woman had left a hospital 3 hours after giving birth to be with her family of five children, including her newborn son.
It's a mud floor, and it's wet. There's no insulation. It's just plastic. And this is how people are living, in between their homeland and a country that is housing them, but they're still not citizens.
The BBC's Jim Muir visited a home for children in Beirut, many of whom were taken there after getting caught working in the streets trying to feed themselves, their family. Yusuf here is 6 years old, been brought to the center 3 times, wants to stay.
My family took me away, but the police caught me working again and brought me back. I'm not leaving here again. If I went home without making enough money every day, my cousin would beat me up.
The shelter has coped with 500 children in the past year. That's just a drop in the vast ocean that's engulfed Lebanon.
And here the BBC talked to a young woman volunteering to be a teacher in the Syrian refugee camp in the Bekaa Valley, East Lebanon. She held up a picture of green pastures and butterflies by one of her students.
We can't stop the imagination of the children. Things that happens in themselves, in their drawing is peace, because they want peace. They don't want war in their homes.
They don't want war in their homes, but they have it. Let's go to Jordan. Amman Jordan, Carl Skembri joins us, regional media manager on Syria crisis and response for Save the Children. Carl Skembri, thank you very much for joining us. How many Syrian refugees and Syrian children are in Jordan now, Carl?
Well, we're about 500,000, around 100,000 of whom live in the Zaatari refugee camp. And that's more or less half of them are children.
And have most of them come across directly across the border from Syria on foot, by bus, by car? How do they arrive?
Most of them find a car arrangement until the border, and then they walk the last bit where they are greeted by the Jordanian army, which has now, for the last 2 years or more, has now taken a humanitarian role of assisting and welcoming the refugees here, and then getting them registered in Zaatari camp, and a few of them then can also get out. Actually, the majority of them live outside Zaatari camp in the host community, which is most of the mostly vulnerable people, because they are away from services, hard to reach, and living in some of the most inappropriate housing, and trying to keep up with the rent fees, which keep going up the more the refugees arrive.
Carl, you work with Save the Children. What have you heard in the stories of children coming out of Syria?
Well, we've been hearing all sorts of stories and very disturbing situations that they are fleeing from. The health situation inside Syria is a very concerning one. There is a total collapse of the health systems over there. Their parents, especially the parents of children, are feeling completely disempowered. They feel they've lost all of their authority on children whom they are coming with, not to mention unaccompanied children, who are obviously the most vulnerable. And then once they settle in and they've been displaced from their home and having lost everything, left everything behind, it's not such a difficult situation to think of when you think of Syria as a middle-income country, where any one of us could have been in that situation and all of a sudden you're just facing the unthinkable. And they are now here or in Lebanon and surrounding other surrounding host countries, where children are missing out on their education. A good number of them end up in child labor, having to work to support their families, facing all sorts of also vulnerability issues and even abuse. We keep hearing of very young daughters who are being married in a bid to help the families get through, and the trauma that they are coming with. I've seen so many children drawing a mix of their hopes and what Syria means to them, and also the tragedy that they are coming from.
Carl, could you be more specific? You say these families are vulnerable, it's hard to make ends meet, and yes, we've read about girls in particular, I mean, child labor for everyone, but girls in particular being married off at a very early age. But this is not necessarily a pretty picture here. We're talking about what are the circumstances that they might be married into?
Absolutely. It's anything but pretty, in fact. It's a very worrying situation. And
is this sexual exploitation?
Yes, it is. And it's they are falling victim to the situation. And it's one of the several coping mechanisms that they are trying to adopt. Obviously, not every Syrian family is doing that. We try and engage through other agencies as well. We refer the cases that we know of and try to persuade the parents that this is not the right way forward. It's short-sighted. It's not going to lead to any benefits, nor in the immediate future, not even in the longer term. And we find success stories that resist that kind of push, if you like, to go down that line.
But families are desperate, though, and we understand. I mean, it sounds unimaginable. Cortland Robinson in Washington, here's a question from one of our listeners. What happens when the children see war as a normal part of life? You have a lot of experience, Cortland. What's the answer there?
Well, I think the effect of war on children has been, relatively well studied. There's a great deal more we need to know. I think the effects are manifold. I think you see the problem of, as Carl just alluded, missing family members, children living without parents, several thousand that UN High Commissioner for Refugees has registered as unaccompanied or separated, physical injuries from war and as well as in displacement, and the psychological trauma and distress, both from witnessing family members die, witnessing destruction around them, fleeing, and then moving into camps where sometimes their safety and security is also quite compromised. And I think the short-term effects are quite large in terms of high levels of post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, anxiety. Over time, in many instances, fortunately with counseling and proper psychosocial support, these symptoms reduce and children can get back to more normal function, going back to school, helping take care of chores around the house and that sort of thing. But for some percentage, and it's hard to put specific numbers to, there are long-term effects. They remain depressed, remain traumatized. They remain unable to stay focused on things like schoolwork and personal care and just being a kid. And I think the effects, as we've seen, is they grow up too fast, and there's also long-term developmental effects, both cognitive and physical, when you have malnutrition and the many effects, the psychological impacts of war on these kids. We're going to see, I think, as some of the NGOs put it, a lost generation. I think that's something we really have to pay attention to now and continue to pay attention to. These are not problems that will go away readily. We need many more resources to do the job, but I think we also have to pay attention that this is a long-term problem, both in terms of the displacement and the response to that, the internal as well as external, but also just helping children get back to being kids again is really is going to be decades of work as they grow up and age into adulthood, sometimes unfortunately stunted physically and psychologically by the effects of conflict.
And who knows when we get to anything like stability in this scenario. UN estimating UNICEF, 10,000 children killed outright, a million trapped in areas of Syria, hard to reach with assistance because of the violence. 5.5 million children with their lives kind of hanging in the balance here, rough as it can be. Norman in Enfield, New Hampshire. Norman, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just feel that we cannot stand by and allow this to happen to innocent people. The United Nations takes a vote on this kind of thing that says, sorry, we can't do anything about it. Taking serious chemical weapons is not enough. We have to protect these people.
How would you do it, Norman? Would you Would you put troops in? Whose troops?
I don't know. I'm not an expert. I just know in my heart that what the West is supposed to stand for is a free world. We can't allow this kind of hell to take place on the earth. We have to do something.
Norman, I understand that sentiment entirely, and I appreciate your call. One more right here, Madison, Wisconsin. Joanne, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I was wondering whether or not the U.S. is taking in refugees, and if they are, what is being done with them?
Refugees to the U.S. I will ask on that, and one more on that front. Toby in Enid, Oklahoma. Toby, you're on.
Yes. We all talk about what somebody else can do. I would like to talk about what I can do. I am a foster parent, and it would be my honor to adopt one of these children that doesn't have anywhere to go and has no family. And I'd like to encourage everyone to go through the red tape and do what's necessary to give someone a better life. Because I mean, if 1,000 people would do that, that's 1,000 children.
Toby, that is undeniable. And there you are, ready and wondering. Cortland, are there refugee flows that come all the way to the United States? We have lists at our website of things people can do to help there. But what about helping here? Our caller asked, can refugees be sponsored here? Can children be helped, even adopted as foster children here?
I would say first, on the refugee admissions, there are some number, I think a very small number, that were admitted last year, only 30 or so. The U.S. has recently eased some of the different immigration laws that would enable more Syrian refugees to be admitted to the United States. I think the U.S. has led the world for quite a long time, decades in fact, with resettlement of refugees. In fact, we admit more per year than all other countries in the world combined. It was about 65 or 70,000 last year. I think there will be places for Syrian refugees. I suspect it will not number more than a few thousand initially. It's not a solution for 2.5 million people outside their homes, but I think it is a durable solution that we must promote and propose for those who are most vulnerable. Often those can be children or people who are traumatized by torture needing specific and additional medical care that can't be provided locally, or people with family links or other links to the United States. But I think the issue of adoption is a problematic one, and I would encourage the caller to focus really on trying to promote local solutions first and foremost. When we see unaccompanied separated children, we don't always know where the family members are, whether both family parents are dead, and that would make them an orphan. These are very traumatic times. Lots of displacement occurs, and tracing is very hard to do. So before we start looking for international adoption, that really is a last resort for a small group of people or children who really do not have any other alternative. I think there are local solutions, which are really about finding those kinds of foster care and alternative care modes that groups like Save the Children and UNICEF are professional and adept at promoting, finding those local answers, which are going to be available for larger numbers in a shorter period of time.
Localizing closer to Syria. Toby, thank you for your call there. Let me get Ruba on, if I may, from Boston. Ruba, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. So I'm originally from Aleppo, Syria.
Yes.
And I still have my mom and my brother there. I have a whole bunch of friends and relatives live there. They are living like a hell right there. But, you know, the situation is very, very bad. I know that we're talking about the refugee camps, but let's talk also about the people that they're living every single day without electricity, without water, without food. This war has to be stopped at some point. I don't know. It has to be stopped. It's just unbelievable what's happening there. Every single day that I'm listening, you know, I'm hearing that someone is got killed or walking by the street, getting his kids from school. There's no school anyway. My friends are not sending their kids to school because they are afraid to send them to school. We're living here in a nice, very nice country. We are blessed to be lived here, but at the same time, our heart is back there.
I'm sure it is, Ruba. We can barely imagine families still living there. I appreciate your call. Carl, do you see any end in sight? We haven't heard it in this hour. Carl Skembery in Jordan, can you see some conclusion to this suffering?
We have to really put all our pressure on the international community, and we've seen results, as alluded to earlier by one of your callers, when there was the intention, the political will to put an end to the chemical weapons issue, there was an agreement reached within a few days, and it is now being carried out, the outcome of that agreement. We have a resolution, a UN resolution passed a few weeks ago, that we haven't yet seen really giving any tangible results on the ground, and that is getting aid access to all the besieged areas inside Syria, getting it to all those who need it. But that is also a stopgap measure. That is the immediate saving lives. What we want is an end to the conflict. And if the international community wanted to do this, there could be much more pressure exerted on all the warring parties and getting an agreement to get both the aid to those who desperately need it, and eventually, yes, to get peace inside Syria.
More, or maybe less likely, just in the last few days, is the U.S. and Russia now at odds over Crimea. Hard to picture them deepening their cooperation over Syria. We don't have an answer today, but we wanted to open the window big and wide for people to remember and see and think about the suffering that's going on there among the children in particular. Carl Skembery with Save the Children in Amman, Jordan. Thank you very much for helping us do that, Carl. Thank you for being with us. And Cortland Robinson at the Center for Refugees and Disaster Response at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Cortland Robinson, thank you so much. Good luck with your work.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.